life, don't miss it.
Want to see the world from a totally different perspective?
Ready for provocative conversation?
Intriguing stories?
And inspiration?
Then don't touch that dial.
Welcome
to Talk with Francesca.
She'll give you something to talk about all week long. Now,
here's Francesca.
What if you took the time to really soak it?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Talk with Francesca. I'm Francesca Bastrash. You're listening to AM 1510 WWZN Revolution Boston. If you've got questions or comments during or after the show, visit my website, talkwithfrancesca.com, to send me a message. You can also find me on Facebook at Talk with Francesca. I love all your emails. I read every single one. So please continue to tell me what's on your mind. All right, then, let's get started. The many ways to make a baby and other baby business. What is the ideal time to conceive a child? Nature still demands the young for this oh-so-important decision. What to do if you wait too long, i.e., don't. Today with me here now, live, loud, and local, in the studio is Dr. Brian Berger, Medical Director of Boston's IVF Donor Egg and Gestational Carrier Program, right here on AM 1510 WWZN Revolution Boston.
Thank you, Dr. Berger, for making the trip here and being on Talk with Francesca.
It is my pleasure. It's great to be here, and I hope we have a interesting and informative session today.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start with years ago. I remember hearing so much about women in their 40s having children. It seemed that it was understood that, of course, being 40, 45 was no problem at all. But it really, in fact, it's not that commonplace, is it?
No, so there certainly is a lot of press about women getting pregnant in their 40s and having babies into their 40s. Mm-hmm. It seems that every other day another celebrity is having a baby at 45 years old. So looking at the stories in the popular press and People magazine,
right.
It is not surprising that people think that fertility is very much intact and normal well into the 40s. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. So it's really doing a disservice to women out there that are thinking that they're going to wait, hold off before having children. And why is it so easy, it seems, for celebrities to have these children?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Celebrity eggs are not better than non-celebrity eggs. You might think they're special, but they're not special in that way. The reason is that most of the patients that are getting pregnant in their mid or late 40s, and sometimes even early 40s and late 30s, are using gametes from other women, meaning they're using donor eggs.
Certainly
once one gets really much past 43, 44 years old, the chances of needing an egg donor to get better eggs are very high. In fact, the majority of healthy pregnancies at that age are probably going to be from donor egg.
What's the best time for a woman to start thinking about having a family?
Well, you know, ideally, and this is not to tell women what to do, but ideally, if women are trying to maximize their fertility potential, really late 20s, early 30s is probably ideal. That's when the eggs are at their healthiest and women are most likely to conceive without needing help or without any difficulty. Once one gets to mid and late 30s, we can certainly do lots of things with our treatments, and that's really where we specialize, and I specialize in that in particular, at getting patients with lower ovarian function, lower fertility potential to have successful pregnancies and conceive healthy babies. Once we get into the 40s, and particularly the mid to late 40s, it's very difficult for us to have success without going to other options, and that's really third-party reproduction, using eggs from other women is the majority of those patients.
But what about in vitro fertilization? Is there a time frame that is there a time when a woman can't use that anymore?
Well, it's the same thing. It whether one's trying to conceive on one's own or whether one's doing it with fertility treatments. Fertility treatments can only use the potential that's there. So yes, we can do IVF, and we do obviously IVF procedures for women, particularly in late 30s and early 40s.
Late 30s, that seems kind of young for IVF, no?
No, that is the bulk of our patient population. So really, once one is past 35, 36, the numbers really shoot up. And we need to be more aggressive and use things like IVF. Not that we jump to that as our first step, but there's a much greater chance we'll need to get there.
And what's the cutoff for IVF and going into egg donors?
We don't really have a strict cutoff per se, and we have done IVF all the way up to age 45.
Oh, wow.
But success rates, once we get to 43, 44, really plummet, and we're looking at success rates in the single digits, less than 10% chance of a healthy baby.
So what is the scope of infertility in the U.S.?
So infertility is roughly about 15% of the population, of the reproductive age population. That translates into about 8 million infertile couples in the United States. If you go with the definition of trying to conceive for at least a year without success, if one is under age 35. If you're over age 35, we actually shorten the definition to 6 months. So 6 months trying to conceive without success defines a couple as having infertility. And again, it's a significant percentage of the reproductive age population.
So why does it seem so many women, or so many more women in the past, say 10 to 20 years, are they becoming more infertile? Or what is that about?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. The question comes up all the time. Is there a greater incidence of infertility today compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago, our mother's generation, our grandmother's generation?
Yeah, because it seemed like they were popping them out like crazy back then. I lived in a neighborhood where there was, you know, nine kids on one side, eight kids on the other side. I came from a family of eight kids.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe no one had a TV. I don't know.
Well, I think that was part of it. But I think the bigger piece of it was really that they were conceiving at a much younger age.
Yes. I think that, yeah, exactly.
So the big difference, if one looks at our parents, our parents' parents, our great-grandparents, they were having babies in their late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, maybe late 20s, but that was kind of pushing it in those days. Very few of them even got to their 30s. And if they got to their 30s, it was probably the fifth, sixth, seventh kid that point. It was definitely not their first one, two, or three.
And why does that make a difference of having that they're able to get pregnant later in age if they've had children earlier? Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Not necessarily. If you look at the gap between children, it actually starts to increase because their fertility efficiency gets worse.
Okay.
So whereas the first children might have been every year or every 18 months, once they get to their 30s and certainly late 30s, it might be every other year or every 3 years or every 4 years because of the efficiency going down. So even in those women, if they carried on having children into their 30s, it was different. But the main reason why fertility was not a problem, because let's face it, it's not going to be a problem if you've got five kids and you're not able to have your sixth kid. Nobody's going to talk about it and nobody's too worried.
Exactly.
It is a problem if you're trying to have your first kid and you're 36 years old and you're having difficulty.
It's too bad, though, because really, I think, this is just my opinion, but I think that women who are a little older are more mature and better suited to be a better parent. I mean, I question, you know, these kids having kids, you know, and I mean, a 16-year-old girl, 17-year-old girl, or not even, say a 20, 22-year-old kid, I think they're young. I think that, you know, I think it's a crazy time to have a kid.
So you could argue that at the time when we were best suited to have children, which
is the worst time to have
probably them. In, as you said, mid-30s or even late-30s for some women. I'm generalizing.
Yeah, but
is when nature really plays a cruel joke on us and doesn't let women conceive. So the biology is such that the egg quality is best in the teens and 20s and maybe early 30s, and that there is a decline in egg quality and in the genetic quality of the eggs once one gets to mid and late 30s. That's not true for everybody. There are women who conceive very easily at age 39 and 42, and we all know the patient that is, you know, down the road and popped out two kids at 42.
Ouch.
It happens.
Young. old.
But everyone knows that story because it is the exception.
Because it is. That's right.
It's the rule. So it becomes the rule because you talk about it.
It's such a shame. It really is. I mean, I just, you know, I know back, you know, years ago, and I'd hear that all the time. I had a very clear picture that having women well into the 40s was, you know, having children into the 40s was no big deal at all.
Yeah,
and that's where ovum donation, I guess, now comes in, right? Because now
that's
the younger girls have the eggs.
That's right.
Right? So let's talk about that a little bit.
So if we get to the point, remember, this is not the bulk of our patient population, even though that's what we're talking about. But the bulk of our population is going to have success without having to use somebody else's eggs.
With in vitro fertilization.
And it might be with fertility treatment, and it might go as far as in vitro fertilization. It's not all we do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly the most aggressive.
If you don't do
so, we do ovulation induction therapy, which means we can give medications. There's oral medications. Clomid is one of the more common ones we use. There are injections, hormone injections of a hormone called FSH or follicle stimulating hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And we use that quite effectively to try and stimulate the ovaries, to get the ovaries to respond and behave better, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
If those somewhat simple, low-tech treatments don't work, we sometimes get to the high-tech treatments, and that's where IVF comes in, or in vitro fertilization for those who are unaware of what IVF is. And that's where we actually take eggs and sperm and put them together in the laboratory, and we actually watch them fertilize and watch them develop.
That's a very stressful procedure, is it not? I mean, you hear about the
it is.
The fathers or the hope to be fathers having to give their wives shots, and they go through one cycle after another cycle after another cycle. And but from what I understand, you have a better success rate than a lot of the docs out there. Is that true?
You know, without bragging, it is true, and we like to,
and why
think
is that
we are very good at it. Yeah, it's a combination of things, and I think it's that we individualize care, and we pay very special attention to things like stress levels and the experience that the patient has. We're not just trying to get them pregnant by shooting them up with medications and doing things in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we do in part, but that's not the whole picture.
I do believe, actually, stress plays a very big part in whether or not a woman can get pregnant. Years ago, I owned a yoga studio. And so many women would, this is when I was back living in Connecticut, many women would come in, their doctors would say, you take a yoga class, get yourself to relax a bit. I mean, some of them were going through in vitro, some of them weren't. Well, there was this woman, she was actually in her 40s. And she was taking yoga classes from me for, I don't know, 6 months. And then she disappeared. And she called me one day and she said, you know, I wanted to let you know why I haven't been at your place. And she said, you know, I haven't gotten my period, and I thought that I was going through menopause.
Uh-huh.
She said, but I'm pregnant. And I said, oh, okay, well, you're attributing that to yoga. She said, well, I don't know what it is, but it did relax me. And then I said, well, congratulations. She said, you know, I don't even remember doing it. And I said, well, you got to do it to get pregnant. Yeah. But that was an interesting, I've always remembered that story. And there was, I'm certainly not saying that, you know, relaxation is the only thing, but I don't know, it's got to be pretty, pretty stressful.
And we believe strongly in reducing stress levels, and that stress plays a role. We actually have a complementary health center. It's called the Domar Center.
Yes, Alice Domar, right?
Alice Domar, who is very well known, arguably the best known person in stress reduction relating to infertility.
Mm-hmm.
She actually works at our center and is a close friend of mine. We do a lot of things with the Domar Center, and they have had great success at reducing stress levels in a variety of different ways to help do what we do. So it's not considered to be the treatment. It's considered to be, again, a complementary treatment.
Yeah, exactly.
To the fertility treatment, and it works very, very well hand in hand.
Well, we are, you know, mind and body are connected. You know, no matter what anybody says, right?
That's exactly right.
So anyway, you're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm here with Dr. Brian Berger, who is the medical director of Boston's IVF Egg and Gestational Carrier Program, right here on AM 1510 WWZN Revolution Boston. Dr. Berger, what are the risks and complications of fertility treatments?
Well, you know, one of the things that keeps people away from fertility treatment is the concerns, the risks that they've heard about, many of which really are not true. So there's lots of misperceptions about the risks of treatment.
Like carrying 4 kids?
That's the biggest one.
Yeah. So that would be scary.
The biggest one that I think keeps people away from treatment, and it's a great shame, but again, because of the celebrities or the cases that have been out there in the press, you know, Octomom obviously being the worst, they think that if you go to get fertility treatment, if you're getting help, you are automatically going to get multiples. And that could be 2, 3, 4, 5, or 8.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not true. It actually depends on what you do, how you do it, who's treating you, and choices that you make. For example, if people are doing IVF, in vitro fertilization, that's where we take eggs and sperm and we inseminate the eggs and we watch them fertilize and develop, we actually get to choose how many embryos we are going to transfer into the patient's womb, into her uterus.
Mm-hmm.
If we transfer one, the patient can only have one. If we transfer five, the patient can theoretically have five. But again, it's a decision that is made with the patient and the doctor, with the patient driving the process even more than the doctor. The patient's decision is absolutely critical to the process.
So so let's say that three eggs get fertilized. Mm-hmm. You would not insert all three eggs into the woman unless she says okay.
That's right. And actually, unless it's indicated and she is agreeable. And being agreeable is obviously key.
There's three eggs fertilized, it doesn't mean that they will continue to grow.
That's right.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they'll grow even in culture when we're watching them, and it certainly doesn't mean they're all going to become babies. So just given human genetics, less than half of embryos that we develop, that we grow, that we observe, less than half of them have the potential to be babies. So even if we transfer two, the most likely outcome, if she is successful, is going to be just one. It's not going to be twins. It's going to be one in the vast majority of cases.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly about 25% of those patients might end up with twins. And therefore,
that's not a bad thing, though.
Exactly. If patients are open to the idea of twins, and I have to tell you that about 90% of our patients actually want twins.
Yeah, why not? After they've been through to try to get pregnant in the first place.
Exactly.
Get two and get them over with.
So the people that walk around with twins, by and large, are the people that want to have twins. They're the people that actually consider that to be an ideal outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And they request that we transfer two, even if I recommend we transfer one.
Okay.
But we're not doing irresponsible things such as the Octomom case where the doctor transferred
crazy
8 or 10 or some outrageous number to a very young patient. It's unheard of. It's unethical.
Right.
It's maybe even considered malpractice or illegal.
Right.
So given that information, we can control the risk of multiples and we can control it in a very precise way. And we commonly do single embryo transfers, or occasionally we will transfer two or maybe three, but again, it depends on the clinical situation. If somebody's 42 years old and I transfer three embryos to that patient, she's not having triplets. In fact, she's going to be extremely fortunate
if she has one. Yeah.
So that's not a risk. On the other hand, if I transferred three in a 25-year-old patient, that would be a bad choice. We're not going to do that. So that's the patient where we're going to transfer one and maybe two if she really wants to have twins or thinks that's a good outcome.
So that's a risk. So you're minimizing the risk, but that is a risk.
It's a controlled risk, and it's very much dependent on what the patient wants and the clinical situation. So we don't do things willy-nilly, and we're certainly not cowboys out there trying to make multiple gestations or risky pregnancies for patients.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, and I think this is shared by my colleagues, a high-risk pregnancy is sometimes worse than no pregnancy. We're not trying to get quadruplets for somebody. That's not considered a successful outcome.
Right.
That's considered actually a disastrous outcome.
What about the risk of cancer with fertility treatment? Is there a risk of that?
Yeah, so again, another misperception is that the treatments that we do, even if they are successful and patients have their babies, are going to have long-term consequences, cancer being one of them. And that's been shown unequivocally to be untrue. So there is no long-term risk of cancer, and I'm talking about breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, all the cancers that might be on the radar. None of those are actually increased by our treatments, short-term, long-term, ever.
So where's this coming from? Where are people coming up with science?
Well,
don't do it in vitro because you could get cancer.
Again, a lot of it has to do with maybe a case that is publicized. There was one recent case of breast cancer that people associated with IVF treatment, which of course was not true.
Mm-hmm.
That I think was the last name was Rancic, if you're familiar with that case.
Mm-hmm.
The other area where there might be misperception is that there was a study in the 1980s, which was a retrospective epidemiologic study, poorly done, poorly researched, which said that fertility drugs cause cancer. It was later shown to be completely untrue and just bad science, but that message sort of persisted in the public arena. Today, much better studies, long-term, large studies, well-done, prospective, all the right ingredients, all showing conclusively that there's no increased risk.
What about birth defects?
Well, again, another thing that unfortunately gets press that is poorly understood or misinterpreted, if you will, there is an increased chance of having a baby with birth defects after fertility treatment. So that is
true.
There
is, okay.
But it's not from the fertility treatment.
Oh.
So
what is it from?
It's the nature of the population doing fertility treatment that comes in with an increased baseline risk. So, for example, I know that sounds complicated, but I'll try to explain it.
I know. You could see the look in my eyes. Yeah. What? What?
So if one is comparing patients who do fertility treatment and outcomes of their babies, there is an increased chance that those babies are going to have, or an increased incidence, should I say, that those babies are going to have birth defects. So the risk of birth defects in the general population is about 3%. The risk of birth defects in the fertility population is about 6%, or double. However, the patients doing fertility treatment are not the same as all the patients in the world. They're not the same as the patients who have the baseline risk of 3%. They're patients who come in with diseases, with older age, with chronic conditions for which they take medications, with
what about the antidepressants that women in that, you know?
There is a higher incidence of taking antidepressant medications, which, as you rightly suggest, causes some cardiovascular defects, for example. So they're not the same patient population. It's not the fertility treatments that increase their risk. It's the population coming in. And that
and
has
that.
Actually been demonstrated
in
several really well-designed studies where they compared a fertility population that got pregnant with fertility treatment to a fertility population that got pregnant without fertility treatment. So they were able to look at them over time, and some of them conceived without needing treatment.
Right.
And the birth defect risk was exactly the same in the patients that did not do the treatment. And that demonstrates, I think, very well that it's not the treatment that's causing the problems. It's the patient population. So really, we feel very secure that the treatments that we do not cause birth defects.
We're talking to Dr. Brian Berger. What advances in fertility therapy have been made in the past 10 years?
Well, you know, we've done a lot in the last 10 years. We've certainly seen our success rate skyrocket. So we have roughly about a 50% increased success rate with treatments. That's IVF and other treatments too, over, say, what we were doing 10 years ago. We have better lab media. We have better medications. We have better treatment protocols. We certainly have fine-tuned what we do a lot better than what we were doing before. The latest advances really have to do with freezing of embryos. We're able to freeze embryos more successfully with the new technology. We're also now, for the first time, able to actually freeze eggs as well, which we have not been able to do before.
Oh.
So we've been able to freeze sperm for really 100 years, and that's not a new technology, and sperm are very easy to freeze. We've not been able to freeze human eggs successfully until really the last few years, and that's a huge advance.
Dr. Berger, we just have a few minutes left, but before we finish, I would like to just talk a little bit about egg donation. Who is the best candidate, when it's just too late, and a little bit about how that works. So let's just take the next 3 or 4 minutes to talk about that.
Yeah, so when patients come in to see us and they've exhausted all the other options, obviously it's not the first thing you want to do, but if patients are not able to make eggs of their own that are good, and by and large these are patients in their 40s, although there are exceptions, then one of the things that we suggest to them is to do egg donation. That means using eggs from a younger woman, from younger women.
Right.
That means either using eggs from anonymous women, and there's actually agencies that have you know, whole long lists of women who are willing to donate that they can choose from.
So you have nothing to do with that?
We don't do anything in terms of recruiting the egg donors, but we do connect them with agencies that do a very good job at that are reputable, that we work a lot with, and let them make their own choices. And then, of course, we screen the donor. The donor goes through an IVF cycle and gives us her eggs, and then we use those eggs to make an embryo and put that back into the recipient. That's the woman who's going to be carrying the baby.
Right.
We do that up to age 50. So we do that well through the 40s. And, and again, 50 is a pretty, should we say, liberal cutoff. We do not do it after age 50 because we think ethically it starts to become questionable after 50.
Well, you know, it's I guess what I question is warm bottles, hot flashes. I don't know. They don't seem like they go hand in hand. It seems like an incredible recipe for stress. And at some point, you got to kind of look at the whole picture and say, well, you know, when a woman is either in perimenopause or menopause, you know, and her hormones are changing, and then she's got the baby, it just seems like it gets to be. I mean, I would think, let me just ask you, what do you really think is the time for a woman to really stop? To say, you know what, this wasn't the chapter that I, you know, wanted in my life, but it's come and it's gone and that's it.
You know, that's a question really that only
a woman
can answer. And
I
don't want to state what the number is. Again, as a policy, I've said 50 as a cutoff in our center. So we've decided that 50 is the age at which it's not good anymore. It's not because of the stress and the hormones and all the things you just mentioned entirely, although that's a piece of it. We're really trying to think of the baby and the life that baby's going to have.
Right. There's a whole psychological element to that. And
yeah,
later.
So we're taking care of two interests here. And the baby's interest, you could actually say, supersedes the mom's interest in this case. And I think that it's not right for children to be in middle school and have a parent in her mid-60s. There's something wrong with that.
I agree with you, because when I was just a kid, my my best friend at the time was being brought up by her grandparents. And it was noticeable for me. And I think it's hard for a kid when their parents get to be
and loss of a parent at a young age, teens and even in the 20s is a devastating event. And something that obviously is going to happen, whether or not they do treatment.
Right.
But if we can help to prevent that, really we should. And that's one of my roles as a physician, is to prevent that from happening as much as I can.
Well, Dr. Brian Berger, thank you so much for being on Talk with Francesca today. Is there anything that you would like to tell the folks that are listening here, anything that you think is important that we might have missed?
Yeah, you know, if there's one message that I'd like to leave the audience with, it's that if one is in her 20s or early 30s in a situation where she is able to start a family and thinking about delaying it till mid or late 30s, you know, please rethink that, or at least go see your doctor and maybe get some tests done to look at your ovarian function, to look at your fertility potential, maybe get some information, and then make an educated decision. It's always so sad when somebody comes to me and they're in their late 30s and they just thought they had lots of time, and it turns out we're struggling or we're not going to have success. And it's just sad. And if we can prevent that, it would be
a very
good
compassionate
message.
Man, obviously. Do you have a website where people can go and find out more about your center?
Yeah, so they can go to www.bostonivf.com.
Okay.
So bostonivf.com. There's lots of information on there, lots of educational materials, links to our bios, links to our treatments that we offer, and also indications of where our centers are located as well.
Great. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, then. If you wanted a child but couldn't conceive, what would you do? Next up, we're going to be talking about the psychological side of egg donation and other assisted reproductive alternatives. I have a few questions, folks, so stay with me here. Would you be willing to carry another woman's egg in order to have a child? How would you feel about not being part of the biological equation of your child? You tell me. What are your thoughts on young girls being recruited to sell their eggs to older women who have none left? Why do these girls do this, and how do they feel years later? If it were you, would you question the fate of your eggs, or would you consider this an act of kindness? It's all straight ahead. Don't go away.